Okay, I thought there was going to be a countdown, but there wasn't. Hey, Deb, welcome back.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back.
I'm really looking forward to our chat today. So you recently posted a blog post, which I will read because I want to get the title correct. It is called Still Stewing About the Last Fight with Your Partner, A New Framework for Understanding Relationships. And it was really cool and really fun. And it's really exciting to talk to you about it. So let's start there. I mean, what can you tell me about the three P's?
So it's great because this is my life now that I'm a depth psychologist, as every moment I'm just more aware of when something wants to come out of my unconscious. And there are certain things that I do that allow that. So I really never understood, why do I need to walk? I just feel like I have to get up and walk around. And so during my morning walks, things will happen. So the way that this podcast or this blog post came about is sort of helps make the point that just being open to the hidden agenda of your unconscious, that there's something else going on. So the day before, a client texted me feverishly and said, oh my gosh, like I had this fight with my boyfriend and do you see couples? And I thought, yeah, but I have been seeing her for a long time. And I thought, well, how do I see them in a way where I can sort of even the playing field? And so on my walk, all of a sudden these three words came to me, and the words were purpose, projection, and permanence. And I went on to have this coaching session with her, just saying, you know what, before we get started and you each sort of tell me your perspective, what if I offer a concept or a couple of concepts to you, and you can look at your experience through this lens. And so it's kind of like an equalizing factor. So as they each shared their perspective, they kept these three words in mind. And it ended up just being a beautiful session that completely changed their relationship. It's been months and they're like, aha, now we still have this way. We have this awareness that there's something beneath the surface. And so we are able to resolve conflicts much quicker. So who hasn't had a fight recently, right?
Yeah. And I guess once you begin to become aware of unconscious drives, right, it becomes much more obvious why things happen the way they do and what role we play and what role we think we play in them, right, in relating to other people.
Yes. And I think the other thing it does is just cause like less seriousness. It feels like once you know that there's some other hidden force, it makes you blame your partner less. It also makes you wonder about your part in it. And it sort of disarms and disrupts the normal sort of process back and forth that we can get into that just fuels, right? When we have mutual complexes that get activated, it just feeds the monster. Yeah. So it also can, when you find a hidden agenda, it also can just make you laugh. Yeah. You know, and laughter is just a better way
best.
Yeah, exactly. So the first concept is this idea that there is a hidden purpose to why you are in relationship with who you're in relationship with. And when you think about it, it can be unsettling. Like there was a certain point when I realized this and I thought, no, I can't trust myself. No. Why I'm doing what I'm doing. And then I settled down a little bit. But when I found, when I realized that there was another reason that I married my husband, who after 24 years, I had to divorce, it was quite shocking to me that I loved him. So it wasn't like many people will actually admit, that day I got married, I kind of knew I shouldn't, but I was too afraid to do whatever. I loved my husband. Like I loved him.
Yeah.
And I went on and I went on and went on. And then I had midlife raveling eventually. And then one day I was like, all this stuff started coming out of my unconscious, really challenging things, boundary issues, and things that just put me in odd situations. And I began to realize that there was this hidden reason that I married him, and it was for safety. I didn't know it. I was a quite rebellious, outspoken, feminist, independent woman. Like, don't hold that door open for me. Let me hold that door open for you. And so it was really surprising for me to realize that one of the reasons that I said yes to him was a kind of safety mm-hmm. from the chaos that I had been feeling about my own sexuality and my own relationship experiences, that I was right. confused, that I was, and this was the 80s. So it was a time when women were like, yeah, I can have sex too. And, you know, and yeah, I'm doing this. And it was just really confusing because we are also demonized for being independent women. So, so you can, you know, pretend that you're not absorbing any of that stuff. And then, but you do. And then later on you realize. So in a way I settled, I didn't think I was settling, but in a way I realized that I knew I could trust this man and he respected me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until my marriage was falling apart that I realized I didn't have the kind of passion that I now knew I could experience.
Right. So yeah, and it took a long time to get to that point.
Yeah. But, and then once I, you know, explored that, then I started getting really curious about the purpose of relationship or going forward. What I got curious about was, okay, when I go out there and go on a date, what is it? Like, yeah. Why am I there? Is it, and your ego might say, well, I'm there to have a romantic experience, yeah. But then there's always something in the background happening. So that's the first concept is, if you go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just going to say, so I think we're looking at purpose in two realms here, right? There's the purpose of specific things that happen, and then there's purpose of relationships in general. And they're not mutually exclusive because it's really the unconscious drives that we aren't consciously aware of that are making us, for lack of a better way of describing it, see things in a particular way, right? And consequently making certain decisions based on those things. And it, like what you're saying with your husband, like in the beginning, you know, when you first got married, you didn't know any of these things about yourself. And it was all about what feels right, what feels good. You love him and it seems like that's what's right. Right. Mm-hmm. Even if perhaps it might have been difficult to articulate exactly why you love him, other than the sort of aspects that make you feel good and supported and nurtured and all the things that we sort of look for in relationships. Mm-hmm. But actually, there was a lot more to it than that. And what you're suggesting is that all relationships are like that, romantically and otherwise, right? It's a matter of, what exactly does this relationship, what purpose does this relationship serve for me? And then on a more micro day-to-day kind of a scale, it's, you know, we just had a fight or this thing just happened. Why, you know, I acted in a certain way, they acted in a certain way, but what purpose was that serving, right? And do I, or they know you even about, do we even know about that? And oftentimes we don't. And that's why it's called the unconscious, right?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And it's actually, yes. So then what happens when the relationship stops working? It had purpose. Mm-hmm. So often when a relationship doesn't work out, that's when we try to find what was the underlying purpose. There was a purpose. I experienced love. I had children. I had support so I could be an entrepreneur. So one of the things I also did after I found the hidden agenda, I could have then felt bad, right? I could have felt like, oh, I did that. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe I should have seen earlier that something was wrong and I need to. No. My unconscious wanted me to have that experience. I used to call myself a slow learner. Mm-hmm. I stayed in that marriage for 24 years. Should I have like seen? No. It's all what was supposed to happen. And so then I started exploring, well, what happened during the course of that relationship? I was able to develop my masculine sensibility, mm-hmm. right? So the masculine being, I became a business owner and an entrepreneur. I did things that I wouldn't have been able to do without that feeling of safety.
Yeah.
Right. So even in the, it didn't work out, there was this there were these things that I was accomplishing, that I was growing in a way. And it's almost like when things started coming to the surface, it was like, okay, now you're strong enough. Mm-hmm. Now you're strong enough that these things are bubbling up. And it led to an unraveling that perhaps I was ready for. And so there is no, that was good, this is bad. It really is just is.
Yeah.
And it was the young, yeah.
And it's not helpful to look at it as good or bad, right? It's like everything, there's, it's life's gray and there's good and bad parts to things. And, you know, often when people have a relationship and then they break up and they're like, well, that was a waste of 3 years or whatever. And, you know, to me, I do understand what they're saying, that because they were like, well, I'm dating to find a life partner on a sort of very general sense. And, you know, because this didn't work out, I now have 3 less years to do so, or I have to start again, or all of these kinds of fears and rationalizations and explanations. But the reality of it is, well, no, you had certain experiences for 3 years, you know, you grew, you developed, you went through a lot. You learned a lot about yourself, because we learn the most about ourselves often in relationships with other people. And then it came to an end, but it doesn't mean that you have to discount or discredit what has been, and you shouldn't either.
Right. So that's a great like opportunity to transition to the second concept, which is projection. So, okay, now what? And a lot of people, you know, might even before they leave the relationship that's meant to end, they will jump into a new relationship without exploring what was the meaning of the first relationship, and is there a different life course now that I'm supposed to sign up with this next person I'm supposed to have an encounter with? And so, you know, so I have clients who jumped into another relationship very quickly. And now what happens is they, once the sort of red flags, they call them red flags, but I'm like, what does that mean? What's a red flag? Let's just dissect and sort through what's happening there. But people will, if they jump into another one, they'll begin to self-judge and doubt themselves. And then because they screwed up the first one, they want to make this one last, they're not really honest. And so a lot of these things continue to simmer. And that's why oftentimes the next relationship won't work either.
Yeah, it'll be the same.
So how do we learn from what was going on in the first relationship? And how do we then grow? So what are the lessons that we're supposed to learn? Why the reasons that we were attracted to the people that we were to teach us certain lessons. If we did not learn those lessons, and we're not aware of the lessons, then the universe will just keep bringing us more of the same until we learn that lesson. So
your philosophy sort of, just sorry to interrupt, your philosophy here rests on a few premises, not that I disagree with them, but just to clarify, is that there is a higher purpose to all things in relationships and the kinds of people you meet and the experiences you have in life, right? It's not random and accidental. And the second one is, you know, even if you're not aware of, premise would be, not a premise, I mean, you're not making an argument, but the second point being that, you know, relationships are meant to help you grow through learning and lived experience, right?
Yes.
Where the assumption there being that one of the points of life is to grow and develop and individuate, as Jung would say, and really just become a fuller version of yourself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's about looking at your past experiences and seeing what can I learn from them, right? Both in terms of how I interact with other people, how they responded to me, and just really examining the dynamics and the experiences that occurred during the relationship at various points in time in the context of the environment and whatever else, and seeing, you know, what lessons are to be learned from there, and how can we use that going forwards to improve ourselves and our future.
Yeah, I like that. A higher purpose. I do subscribe to that. As we, if we look at actually the purpose of being, is to relate and evolve. And Edward Edinger says or suggests that what Jung meant, you know, so mm-hmm. is that that is our purpose. Our purpose is to increase our consciousness. And the only way we do that is by relating. And we relate through projection, which mm-hmm. is this constant mirroring back. And the other thing I want to say is that when you look back at relationships that were less than ideal, a mother relationship, a sibling, a husband, romantic partner, whatever, you also did learn things. You also grew.
Yeah.
So I think that's the other balancing that, oh, don't get like stuck in the mud about that didn't work. Well, maybe the point was it wasn't supposed to work or last. The point was this particular encounter, and that's sort of how I refer to relationship experience now, is an encounter, mm-hmm. is a particular life lesson.
Yeah.
And this particular person might mix with you in a way that you can continue to grow together forever, or it might not be meant to be permanent. It might be meant to prepare you for a deeper relationship experience, because you can't jump from this way to this.
Yeah.
You might need steps. You might need a few in between, which sort of gets to another thing I wrote about, which was, why do we have this odd attachment to the need to find the one?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Like, even think about that.
Well, my go-to thought process these days is quite often to think of an evolutionary perspective. I don't think it's a fully, it's not a full explanation of things, but it certainly provides a useful framework for looking at a lot of our dynamics. But really, it's hard to then get into the psychology domain from evolution. I mean, I know there's evolutionary mm-hmm. psychology and I mean, it's not separate, but, you know, so one might make the argument that, well, the reason we look for relationships in the first place is to sort of pair bond and reproduce, because the quote unquote point of life on Earth for all things is to pass on your genes to the next generation. Now, I think it's a reductionistic kind of approach.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I don't think it's necessarily helpful to think about relationships in that way, because, okay, so what? That doesn't help our experience, right? Like, maybe that explains the drive of why everyone wants to pair bond, right? To one degree or another. But that doesn't really explain much else. That's just like, okay, true, fine.
Well, yeah. Here's how I would respond to that. Okay, that's a biological, to me, that's a biological explanation.
Yeah.
So for creatures who don't have self-consciousness and self-awareness, that's all you can expect. As human beings, if you say, you know, for people who are religious, we are the highest expression of God or creative intelligence, I would suggest a lot more is expected from us than to just reduce the purpose to, yeah, it's about spreading our seed. In fact, Barbara Marx Hubbard, I don't know if you know that name.
No.
And I think she maybe recently passed away, but she was a wonderful, you know, a spiritual teacher that has this concept or created this concept called the evolutionary man and woman. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of transition from understanding creative intelligence is only wanting to reproduce physically to really creative intelligence between men and women is to create all sorts of things, is to create consciousness, is to create ideas, is to create innovative ways of being human being. And nice. So, right. So it's almost that's an evolution. So we can get stuck in the biology, but I don't think I think it's a limiting view. I guess I would say to layer on top of that there is a part of us that is biologically driven, but there also is a psychic DNA, not in addition to a biological DNA. And, you know, neuroscience has not really found the psychic DNA. It's in the unconscious. They're not going to find it, but that's why we feel compelled to become more conscious. We're pioneers.
Yeah.
The last frontier as I think maybe Carl Jung even said, is the unconscious. It's not the bottom of the ocean. It's not even space. It is the unconscious and the collective unconscious. So, you know, this is just my lens. And I think the benefit of my lens, believing that there is higher purpose, is a beneficial lens. It's like an exciting way to look at relationships. It's even, you know, we haven't gotten to permanence yet, but I'm not suggesting that we don't have one relationship.
Yeah.
What I'm suggesting is that the attachment to the idea actually undermines the chances of even staying in one relationship. So yeah. between purpose and this idea of permanence.
Before we go on.
Oh, yes.
I just want to ask you about psychic DNA real quick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what is that?
So Carl Jung would say that in our psyche is actually the psychic experience of the totality of human experience. So just like our biologic DNA contains the DNA of the very first whatever organism,
mm-hmm.
that our human psychic DNA contains the whole history of human experience as experienced by humans. It's all part of our psychic DNA. So even, which is why we can't even really separate ourselves from any sort of collective, anything that's bigger than us, right? So we have a personal unconscious,
mm-hmm.
and we have, but that personal unconscious exists within a collective unconscious of family, of neighborhood, of community, of country, of world, of nature, of the cosmos, of everything, right? So we, our personal unconscious also exists within the whole collective unconscious. So that's why even in dreams or active imagination, something can appear that you cannot even tie it remotely to a personal experience, something mm-hmm. very ancient, some kind of knowledge, right? Because we contain the whole entire psychological history, experience of humanity. So that's what he means by, and those are my words, of course.
Yeah.
I'm not quoting him.
No, so if I understand correctly, in the same way that DNA is the building blocks for our bodies, psychic DNA is an equivalent building blocks for our mind, our psychology, our psyche, right?
Yes. Right. So think about like, just like biology wise, or even, you know, think about how could we continue to like accelerate growth and consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
We don't start all over, right?
No.
So we don't start all over with biology, and we don't start all over with psychology. We have more consciousness. Our consciousness has been raised now than we did 100 years ago. And why? Well, that's when the archetypes come in. So, and the archetypes, of course, are over the whole history of humanity, and it's our psychological experience. What are the ways that we experience things? How do we experience hunger? How do we experience falling in love is relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
There was no falling in love like 5,000 years ago. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like back when all we did was just try to survive, there was no falling in love. That's when biology had to come into play, right? So with grieving is a great example, mm-hmm. like these phases of grieving. So there are these like patterns of experiences of what do we think about? What does mother mean? What does father mean? What does masculine mean? What does love mean? And we become more conscious, and consciousness seems to always become more inclusive over time. So our ideas broaden. And as ideas broaden, that's also scary for a lot of people as well. So, yeah. So I look at, have conversations with my son, for example. He just like gets certain concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Way quicker than I did. He's thinking about things having to do with the planet, for example, or he's thinking about evolution in a way that I couldn't at his age.
Right.
But he has inherited. Yeah, he has the capacity. And part of that is inherited my psychological experiences his fathers, the families, the communities, right? Our culture.
Yeah. So it's a progressive evolution, mm-hmm. right? And it's interesting to think about, you know, the totality of human experience, how that represents, and I mean, what it's like, right? Because in some sense, it's really hard to even think about that because we only have our own experience to go off of and comparing it to other people. And in many ways, there's patterns that you can pick up, right? And this is where we get to like archetypal.
In one really specific way, people can do this. So if they're mm-hmm. like, oh my God, you're so conceptual, like, what do I do with this? Is an experience that I had as I was exploring my own personal complexes that led to me exploring my parental complexes, which, by the way, some people believe, some depth psychologists believe that all first marriages or all first serious relationships are the working out of parental complexes. So that's an example of how you inherited, because your parents were your first model of being in relationships. So that caused you to develop certain perspectives and ways of thinking and behaving that are good sometimes, and sometimes they stop working, and then you have to sort of figure that out. So I naturally, after I explored my own complexes and then started exploring my mother's complex, then I was able to go back mm-hmm. and I made these observations that I hadn't made before about her ancestry. And so my parents had divorced when I was 9. So my mother was married first to my father and then to a stepfather. Her mother, mm-hmm. my mother was abused, had a lot of trauma. Her father was never around. And when he was violent, alcoholic, right? So that was her experience of a father. Her mother's mother, no man around. So going back generations, there were women and there were either bad men or there were no men. And all the women were very mean. And then my father, his father died when he was young, I think 13, and he was not known to be a great man. And then my stepfather, his father died when he was 6. So all of a sudden I was like, there are no men. I never knew a grandfather. There were no men. And all the women were kind of mean. And so when I went into marriage relationship with my husband, I did not want to be that as a wife. So I ended up over-adapting. I overcompensated. So going back and looking at what I had inherited in like my natural instincts was to overcompensate for something. And so it helped me make sense of how I showed up in my own marriage. And then I explored further back. And in an active imagination exercise called a dream council, I invited people going back further in my ancestry. I didn't know who they were. I just said, will you come? Mm-hmm. And when they came, they were dressed like they were in ancient Greece. And I said, oh, thanks for coming. Why are you here? And they said to me, something was stolen from our family. And I said, what? In my imagination. And they said, the love between a man and a woman. Hmm. This all helped me put in perspective sort of my natural interests, my natural passions, what I felt sort of driven to do. And so, you know, I forget the author of The Wounded Researcher often says the purpose of our life is to answer a question that couldn't be answered by the generations before us.
Right. The Wounded Researcher or The Wounded Healer?
The Wounded Researcher.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So I haven't heard of that one before. Yeah.
Yeah. So that he talks about how, you know, most people who are going, you know, pursuing a PhD, they think they really know why they're interested in the topic they're interested in. Well, as depth psychologists, we know they only know 10% of why they're researching this. They are being used as a vessel for the archetypes, the archetypal energies to come in and say, no, 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 your research has a bigger meaning than your ego can even grasp right now. So as depth psychologists, we're aware of that. And all mm-hmm. of that influenced my research on women's experience of reconciling sexuality and spirituality. So once you like open your mind to, you can be scared to know that you really don't know everything about yourself, but it can also be really exciting when you have a framework, when you understand things like projection. Like that's how you can figure out the nitty gritty and sort things out. And so when you have these tools, your life just automatically takes on more meaning. And then you realize that how you live actually is contributing to evolving consciousness, even if you can't see it, but you know it.
Of course. And you know, that would be manifest in any contact you have with anyone else, right? And everything you do in the world has ripple effects, like the butterfly effect. And so we're contributing whether we like it or not in virtue of being alive or in virtue of existing. Mm-hmm. Even if you take yourself out of existence, well, that has a significant impact too, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so while perhaps a hard truth to come to grips with, because it bears a huge amount of responsibility behind it, it's a liberating in many ways.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Well, for certain people, for me, I've always known like I need to have a purpose and I need to find meaning. Yes. So for somebody like me, I really need that.
Yeah. So how does projection come into play here? So, you know, you said that most people's first serious relationship is a recreation of the things that they're perhaps lacking in their parental things or to recreate it, right? Because you can also sort of see this in people who grew up in chaotic households and choose chaotic partners.
Or the opposite. So
or
it's
the complete
not,
opposite, yes.
So I would not say that it's about recreating. I would say that the first serious relationship is a working out of parental complexes. It's like, because we could actually have a very nice childhood. Just say, yeah, that was normal. I enjoyed it. I feel very blessed, whatever it is. We all have what we call parental complexes. All that means is out of our experience with our major caregivers, we developed ways of thinking about things and ways of behaving. Mm-hmm. And so they're just patterns. So I'll use just like a really simple one that seems like it's only positive, but has a dark side. I used to wear eternal optimism as a badge. I was just like, eternal optimist. Like, what do you mean? How can you? No, eternal optimist. And always looking on the bright side. And that sounds like it's only positive. Well, when I was, one of the reasons it took me a really long time to realize that my husband had an alcohol addiction was because of eternal optimism. It kept me blinded from understanding how addiction worked, that it was never going to change unless I really made a major disruption.
Yeah. And so, it doesn't always end optimistically.
Well,
in the
exactly.
Short term.
Exactly. So I clung to certain ideas about marriage. Like, why wouldn't we? Divorce is not an option. Why wouldn't we be able to work it out? Right. So all whatever strong idea you have, but where did I get those ideas from? I got those ideas from my experience of childhood. Right. So I went off into the world with certain ideas about things. Now, we may go many, many years and those ideas were great. They were great for me, really. The first inkling that, you know, my unconscious was speaking to me and I didn't even get it, I kind of ignored it, was when I was 38. Hmm. It really wasn't until 10 years later where then everything fell apart. So it's fine. If there's no issues, everything's fine. But just be aware, you still have complexes. They're just neutral right now. And then and they stay neutral as long as you kind of stay in some sort of boundary. But then when you challenge the boundary, like, oh, I'm not happy in this marriage anymore, or I hate the corporate sector, what was I thinking? Or I want to paint, or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And it pushes you to the edges. Then those they come to the surface and they get triggered, and they're defense mechanisms to keep you in place. So how does projection work then in a relationship? The best example to explore is when you feel really deeply and intensely, because then it's more obvious. Or think about another couple. So don't even think about yourself. Just think about that couple that is a walking romantic comedy, for example. whoa, what are they doing? They're crazy. Why are they doing this? They shouldn't be doing this. But, you know, they got swept up in something. She's irrational. She's going to get hurt. Well, first of all, you're projecting onto that. But yeah. you can see it, right? You can go, why is she with him? He's like, he's so this. She's so that. That's the point. That's projection. So right. You will find yourself attracted to things that you ideal, things that you idolize or idealize that you don't think you have, for mm-hmm. example. So you might be attracted to somebody who's very financially independent and you just really admire that. Like you're aroused by being around a powerful man. So you might want to think about, because really your arousal about that is your unconscious saying, see that? I want that for you. Yeah. I want you to feel like, I want you to feel powerful. And in a lot of couples who are opposites attract.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's what's going on there. So here's what will happen over time if you're not aware of it. You will project that lack in you and require that person to carry the burden of filling that for you. That will become eventually exhausting for them. Mm-hmm. And eventually just less, more disempowering for you. The more that you put somebody else up on a pedestal, you know, right. the more you're repressing what actually wants to come out and play. I'll call it come out to play. So romantic relationships are the easiest ways to see how projection is working. And it's kind of a simple concept and complex at the same time, but simply yeah. it's wherever there's an emotional charge, wherever there's like an emotional charge, there's something going on there. The really interesting kind of projection is where you really admire something in somebody, but you also cringe. You're like, God, and it's a weird feeling because you're like, oh, there's something like, for me during a period of time, during the unraveling of my marriage, when I had to find my voice, I had to find this other part of me. I was obsessed with Millionaire Matchmaker and Tabitha Salon Takeover.
Okay.
Both women who are kick-ass women. And they would say these super mean things. Mm-hmm. And so I was addicted to like their power over themselves and how they could influence people. And then every time they would just be so mean, I would like cringe at it. What's going on there when you both admire and cringe or disdain and admire is there's a version of what they're doing that you're like, that's going way too far, that wants to be developed in you. It doesn't mean you want to be that bitchy person. It means you need to bring out your inner bitch to actually just get you to neutral.
Right. You need to be strong and authoritative. Right.
But your unconscious right. is like pulling in an image that's very exaggerated to make the point.
And also you don't get to control the characters you see on TV. You sort of have to take in the whole package, and you like some and you don't like the rest of it. Right.
Well, right. So there'll be very specific characters that get an emotional charge in you. Mm-hmm. It's like nothing else exists in the world except Millionaire Matchmaker, Tabitha Salon Takeover. And I was like, oh, and I was studying depth psychology at the time. So I was like, what's going on here? What's going on? And then I realized it was like, oh, that thing I'm uncomfortable with, I need to give myself permission to be that. And then when you challenge that complex, that pattern, it feels immoral. Mm. So that's the other part of projection is, for example, a woman who has projected onto her husband financial independence. She's happy to do whatever she's doing with her life. But sometimes there are women who are like, just take care of me.
Yeah.
Right. So she has projected her own potential financial independence onto a man. Now, eventually what might happen is the man might become bored with that. Mm-hmm. He actually might be more intrigued by independent, financially independent women, but he wanted the woman who was dependent on her, right? So we think like we know what we want, but eventually if we don't develop those other parts of ourselves, it's not going to work in the end anyway. And there are many, many stories of women who end up getting cheated on, end up getting divorced, right? And they're like, I thought he was going to take care of me. And she never bothered looking at the financial statements. And now she's like in financial ruin. And so that's another kind of more common example of, you know, if you, whatever you idealize, there's an opportunity to explore, like, why is it that that's so important to me? And what is that mirroring back to me is the question to always ask.
And so I'm just trying to think, like, what's the right way to, because someone might listen to this and say, well, then how can I do anything if I don't know what's going on? You know, how can I start dating someone if, what if the reason I'm attracted to them is for all these unconscious reasons that are going to just blow up in my face later, right? Or, but, you know, so when I was thinking about it, I was like, well, maybe the right way to think about it is like, well, there's no finished product, right, of you. Individuation is a lifelong journey. And maybe a journey or an adventure is the best way to think about it, where you don't get to know all the answers, but you get to have the experience of finding out along the way. And so you don't know necessarily why you're attracted to all these people, and you can look into it and you can learn each time. But as you say, but things change, right? And things that are out of your control, by and large, change, and you have to deal with that too. So even if you knew that you were attracted to someone for their financial independence and you were like, okay, I'm okay with that anyway, or you'd use that opportunity to reflect on yourself and decide, actually, I want to be financially independent too, well, that might then change the dynamic of your relationship, right? And so it's in either direction. It might come from you or it might come from them. It just depends. Like, you can't predict these things.
Right.
And so how do you sort of suggest people take this information to heart?
So two things. The one thing I would say is... Well, it sort of gets to this third concept, which is clinging to permanence. So again, what I'm not saying is like, oh, relationships don't work out. Right. So it's not that they might not. It's like letting whatever it's not being attached to a specific way that they should work out. So Carl Jung also has what I think is a really beautiful concept that he calls a psychological marriage. It's not about like legal marriage. A psychological marriage is a conscious marriage. So it's two people who are like, whoa, we are really swept up in something. Something's going on. I don't know what it is, but let's go with it. You go with it, man. You do not live because you're afraid. Oh, am I projecting? I had to wonder about one of the relationship I got swept in post-divorce with a man that was 15 years younger. I had to wonder, like, is there a mother complex thing going on here with him, with me? Like, I don't, but I'm like, this really feels good. I'm going to do it. And I did it. And that relationship ran its course and it was okay. I would never, never give up that experience ever. So just a psychological marriage just means, ooh, you're really angry, Like every time there's an emotion or a fight or whatever, it's like, And one of the biggest light bulbs for my, the coaching client, the couple was, they kept saying respect. I need respect. I need respect. Now they each come from strong cultural. She's Latina, he's Muslim, very sort of strong, more rigid, conventional. And they're like really busting through those. That's a lot of pressure for a couple, right? So I turned around and I said, what does it mean for, like, what does that mean? What does he do that either causes you to feel respect or causes you to feel disrespect?
Yeah.
And the same thing for them. And just by asking that question, they were like, oh, I never even told them what it meant.
How to even
show respect. So I would just say, be curious and linger and explore. And then when, and yes, and sort of accept it as a journey, but we do like to stay in long relationships because they provide stability for us. Right.
Yeah.
So But the more you cling to the need for the stability is what gets you in trouble. So if you can be like, I'm in this relationship, I don't know what's going on, let's just go for it. And you can kind of be conscious about what's going on. And you can be like, I want it to end, but you know what? I'll be okay if it doesn't. That actually shifts the psychological energy to make it more likely it will last. Mm. And then when you feel that first twinge of self-doubt, is this me or is it him? Is this, what is this? That you're curious about it and that you're honest about it. Here's what I'm feeling right now. When you did this, this is what I felt. And if you have the kind of relationship where you're like, oh, huh, I don't know what that means. Like even saying, I don't really know what that means. Why don't we sleep on that? And so, you know, the key is to, if you can do that, you'll immediately disarm whatever fuel that there would otherwise be to really intensify the situation. If even just having the knowledge, there's something there that we don't know about.
Yeah.
And it also like makes it, it's not your fault then.
Yeah.
There's something more mysterious and complex going on. It's not your fault.
It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Yes.
To deal with.
I mean, there's a behavior, right? So understanding the motivation and the complexity and understanding is not the same as accepting a situation, though. Mm-hmm. So if people seem to have a hard time with that. If I look at another human being as fallible, that doesn't mean I'm excusing his behavior.
Yeah, you're understanding it.
We can hold both those things. I can have compassion that he's got a mother wound or whatever it is, and it just got activated when I said such and such. I can understand that. And then at the same time, that's not a good, I don't want to be treated that way.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, and that makes sense. And I think I'm thinking about like internally, you know, when you understand something but don't accept it, right? But that's more of a, like, the way I see it, it's more of there's the emotional disconnect where, you know, you're like, okay, yes, this is the pattern, this is why it's happening, whatever, whatever, but it still feels terrible, right? It's like, well, you haven't actually integrated that fully yet, right?
Oh, you bring up such a good thing. So you bring up this relationship we have between the masculine and the feminine, the mind and the body, because we can intellectually understand a concept, but until we've processed the emotion, we don't have real knowing. So knowing, to know something is to relate to it. You relate to it through the body. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we need the mind then to say, oh, there's this emotion here. We have to sit with the emotion. We have to linger in the emotion. We have to let it, we have to, in a safe way, that's we're not harming other people. I need to journal. I need to take a walk. I need to swim. I need to go to yoga. I need to feel the anger. And in most cases, when there's projection going on and when there's a negative thing and when there's complexes are getting triggered, the emotion has nothing to do with the event that just happened. It's old. Mm-hmm. It's old. Whenever there's anger, it's old. And so if we can, as a couple, know that, whoa, okay, I know that wasn't about me. I'm going to go.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Or the person. So now my couple clients, she tells me examples of how, oh, this happened. and we both were like, oh, that's about little version of me.
Yeah.
Little version of me not feeling safe. So sorry, that wasn't about you. Or I do that with my children because we can't control. Emotions are not controllable. They just come up. But I think like your listeners, they're gifts. Mm-hmm. A negative emotion is a gift. It's the unconscious saying, okay, you can deal with something you couldn't deal with before. Here it is. Here it is. Here's the emotion. Oh, okay. What is that emotion about? It's not about this thing right now, but that activated an old emotion that, okay, let's explore. Let's journal. What does that make me think about? When is the first time I remember feeling this? Oh, I was six.
Yeah. Real old emotions.
Even by recognizing that right there, you'd be like, oh, so it's not her fault. oh, but when she said this thing, it took me back to my childhood. Now I can say to her, you know what? It wasn't you, but this thing, this particular word is really charging for me. I don't know. I just want to tell you that.
Yeah.
And then she can have more compassion. And then the two of you can work together to work together on that.
Yeah. Negotiate some sort of compromise or a better way of being with each other under those conditions.
Yeah. So sometimes our mind has to say things like that. Or like when I responded a different way to this passive aggressive dynamic with my husband that would occur in certain situations. There are certain situations where I was like, I'm feeling this. And he would say, well, I'm doing this. And then it would be, so there was this little dynamic and it was very harmful to me. So I thought, I don't really know what to do except to do the opposite of what I naturally normally would do. And so that's what I started doing. I was like, well, typically I would do this and smooth it over and do this. And instead I was like, well, I blah, 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 and I walked out the door. But it felt morally wrong. So then in that case, my brain has to say, did you do something morally wrong? No, it felt like it. Well, no, keep doing it. And eventually that will shift in your body because we carry it in our body.
Right. And the emotion of feeling morally wrong is shame.
Right.
Partly.
I don't know. I didn't really think about that. It had to do with like, I'm an over accommodator.
Yeah.
So
it's not shame. It's guilt for sure.
it's perfectionism and playing my role. It's more about playing a role. It's about being a scolded child, not about shame. It's not about shame and guilt with me.
No.
I mean the
experience that you had when you walked out was like, did I do something wrong? That's guilt.
And liberation.
Yes.
Same time.
Right. And that's how you know there's something fishy going on.
Yeah. But that's when you know something's good is happening because you've challenged it, but you need to be able to hold the space for your own challenging what feels morally wrong.
Yes. And you have to be able to cope with it.
Yes. Right? Yes.
In a healthy way.
Journaling, lots of journaling.
Yeah, of course, because those very unpleasant negative emotions, usually people try to get rid of as quickly as possible because they suck, right?
Yeah.
And there's a variety of coping mechanisms, some healthier than others.
Yeah.
So I actually wanted to ask you, you know, in your understanding, so from a depth psychological perspective, what are emotions? It's quite a big question, but generally speaking.
Well, I have a funny answer because I didn't really know the difference between emotion and feeling until I saw the Pixar movie.
Which one?
I don't remember what it was called. It was the first one about emotions. There were six little characters in there and they represented emotions. So I'm like, I just don't understand. I didn't have a knowing because my relationship with emotion wasn't a good relationship. I really wasn't allowed to express negative emotions as a child. Not allowed. And so I had a warped relationship with my own emotions, especially negative emotions. So here's how I understand emotion. Emotions are like core responses of the body to stuff.
Right.
that's my Webster's dictionary. In my mind, emotions happen. They live in the body. I think there's a limited number of, there's a negative one, there's a joy one, there's a sad one, like, and then feelings are how we place meaning. So there's a million different feelings or ways that we can find a meaning for an emotion, but sometimes people don't have that many, right? So one way that your body is feeling is it's much more complex to figure out exactly how you feel about an emotion than you think it is. I think you've mostly been trained by other people that, and how would they know what your body is feeling? But they will say,
This is what it means.
Yeah. They'll say you feel sad. And then look at the bag. What does that even mean?
Yeah, and it attaches to all the other sad things that you've been associated with.
So here's in depth for me, this is my depth psychology, part of my framework, is that look at emotions as one way our unconscious speaks to us, or our soul. So our, if for soul, for some people, or our self, capital S, is that ordering principles, the prompting towards, you're going to unfold a little more. You're going to, I'm not telling you what to do, but I'm prompting you, just prompting you. And you're not getting it right now. So here comes an emotion, get ready, or in a certain situation. So for me, every emotion is a prompting and a message from the unconscious meant to get you to explore something you're ready to explore. So that's how I look at it.
So like information, right? It's one way of receiving information.
Yes. I would say it's like a prompting because it doesn't have a clear message. That's your job. Because remember, the realm of the unconscious is the realm of the feminine. She's meandering. She's not direct. She's like, nope, this is an insight that you need to gain and know in your mind and your body. And when you do, that's the ha-ha, oh my God, what? That's mind-blowing. Or, oh, spiritual orgasm just happened right now because I understood something that I didn't understand before. Mm-hmm. And understanding something about you then leads you to have more compassion for yourself, which leads you to have more compassion for the other. And that's really what we want.
So how would you, in that framework, how would you account for something like fear, like primal fear of an imminent threat? Would you categorize that as not an emotion?
Well, that seems like emotion to me. I have a relationship with fear, but it's not because of anything personal. I have a relationship with a more collective fear that lives in women from centuries of oppression. I like the fear, I only recently came to understand that. And when I understood it, it didn't get triggered as much. So when I am around, or when I used to be, or if it just out of the blue, somebody would say something very misogynistic, mm-hmm. and ground it in warped versions of religious interpretation of doctrine, I felt fear. Mm-hmm. Fear, like I felt, it's really hard to explain because I do not have a personal experience of assault, of rape, I wasn't physically abused, as mean as my mother was, and I wasn't allowed to feel emotion. There's not really a personal reason for me to feel the fear, but it was literally a fear of feeling trapped, bound, burned, killed. It was a fear of being killed, actually. Mm. So that seems like an emotion to me, and I didn't own it, but it was activated in my body, and it's something more, it's for me, it has a more collective meaning. And I am an introverted intuitive, which means I'm sort of more in like connection, the doorways open for like archetypal energies to activate me for the purpose of it mixing with me and expressing something new. That's a more evolved thought that then I can, you know, then I can share with others. So yeah, that's an interesting one that you bring up. I feel less fear now than I used to. You'd think I'd feel more fear with what's going on in the world, but I have a better understanding of like a bigger context of what's going on and what's working itself out. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of why it got activated in me, was for me to explore it.
Right. So that makes sense. And it's very interesting to think about, you know, collective fears that manifest mm-hmm. in us that have no direct causal relationship mm-hmm. in our time. And that goes back to the psychic DNA thing and the collective unconscious, where it's like, well, you don't even have to have experienced it to know it.
Right.
And you might not understand it without thorough analysis about why you have this fear, or you might rationalize it in some way or another. And, you know, there's lots of things you could come up with that, you know, possibly can account for it, but it's not as deep or comprehensive. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, but I guess it depends for the person, right? Because if you've had physical trauma or abuse, like, man, there's a clear link right there.
Yeah.
To suggest that it's actually just the unconscious collective unconscious, that's not fair.
No.
Nor would it be accurate.
Right.
For the most part. And so it might compound, right? Like they might go together, because it's like, well, you might have had this fear from the collective unconscious, and then your actual experience solidified it as a reality. And so now you're afraid of the reality, not a potential reality, right?
Yeah. Yes. And this brings up something just came up for me, another form of projection that we can be guilty of as parents, that combines our experience with what we perceive another person's experience to be. So I had trauma as a child. I was severely bullied. I was very self-conscious, just, you know, that kind of experience. And then my son, from the time he was 3 weeks, I knew he was different. I mean, and then he had sensory integration issues. He had an odd relationship with nature. He did not fit into the box. And he has come to, you know, sort of be a lot like his mother, as a rebel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the combination of being rebellious and being self-conscious is really interesting. It's constant torture, actually.
Yeah.
But anyway, so during a time when he was really just suffering, he wasn't getting what he needed from school, that whole situation. And then as knowledge and awareness of my husband's alcohol addiction sort of surfaced, there was a lot of projection going on, right? And I could see my husband projecting his little boy onto my son's experience. And then I felt so much suffering on behalf of my son that I projected extra suffering onto him.
Mm.
So, and I had a hard time. And this is everybody's thing to work on, I would say, right now in the environment that we're in, is to realize that you view and judge other people's experiences through your own lens.
Yeah.
We can't help it. That's why projection is important. The point of projection and the point of somebody on Twitter actually, you getting triggered and activated, that's a gift for you. It actually has little to do with that person. You can decide how to react to them, whatever it is. That was activated in you for you to explore for you.
Yeah.
Right. So you can, like I said, you can think what you want about the other person, but it's really a gift for you. So it took me some time to be able to separate and have a boundary between my son's actual suffering, which I think probably wasn't as bad as I thought it was, and what I was layering on top of his suffering, not on purpose.
Yeah, of course.
So, and then I'm watching, I'm like, whoa, I'm seeing my husband as a little boy, and I'm seeing, whoa. And we do that to our children. So the other thing for the parents out there is that when adults aren't aware of complexes and the roots of maybe some conflict that they think they're tamping down, they are projecting it onto the children. It's usually one child that will absorb all of the dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And then what will happen is, because that child is receiving all of your psychic dysfunction, they end up being something that's very challenging to your ideas about everything. And so you all think it's him that's the problem. And he's the black sheep.
Problem child.
You have made him so toxic that, and you're not even able to see that really the root of that is in you not dealing with your stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's so sad to see, right? Mm-hmm. Especially with young kids.
Yeah. And we don't know. The parents don't know. Like, that's why I'm on this mission to encourage self-reflection and to give people tools and write quirky articles and funny stories so that they can go, oh yeah, that's happened to me.
Yeah. And in some sense, it's unavoidable though, right?
Of course. Like, yes. Yes.
It is unavoidable. There's no perfect parent who raises a perfect child, and it's a silly aspiration.
Think about it. I really do believe our children don't belong to us. They are given to us. We are just to give them basic care, and then they unfold the way that they're going to unfold. You usually end up getting children that are meant to force you to grow.
Mm.
That's it, right? You get that child. And so from a very early age, I was like, oh, this is really challenging my idea of parenting. But okay, I guess that's the point. That's the point. So if your child's not behaving, if you have an emotional charge around your child's behavior, that's about you, not your child. If you're like, Billy, not appropriate, and you're emotionally neutral, okay. But if you're like, you're triggered and you're like, oh, my child's disrespecting me, that's about you, not about your child.
Yeah. Yeah.
So projection is how we relate. We can't get away from it. It's the only way we grow. So we grow by having things mirror back to us that we're supposed to explore. And it sounds like exhausting, but we have these glimpses of liberation and these moments, and then we find more meaning in our lives. So in the end, it's all really good. Once you have a little glimmer of insight, you can't go back to being blissfully ignorant. Darn. Yeah. But
like walking out of Plato's cave, right? Oh, once you've seen the light, that's the end.
That's the end, right? Yeah. You're doomed, man.
You suddenly know what's real and what's not.
Yes, exactly. Matrix. Love the Matrix.
The Matrix. Take the red pill or the blue pill.
Right.
Which has taken on a really weird meaning these days online.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the point is to see the truth or not to, right? To choose to live in complete blissful ignorance.
Yeah.
Blissful being in quotes.
Right.
But so listen, I mean, this has been a really fun conversation. Yes. Thank you. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Yes.
Please tell everyone where they can find you, what you're working on right now. What can people buy?
Okay. You can find everything about me at deborahlukovich.com. So Deborah Lukovich, Lukovich.com. I have a podcast where I also interview a lot of really interesting topics, and I read a lot of my chapters from my book, which you can buy, and you can get there via my website as well, or find it at bookshop.org if you're looking for an alternative to Amazon. So it's called Your Soul is Talking. Are you listening? And I teach the ways that the unconscious tries to get your attention, mm-hmm. and then also strategies for how to work with those images, whether it's emotions or dreams or film experiences or whatever. Something new that I've really been enjoying is I'm on Twitter. I have to say I've had only a positive experience because I'm surrounded by writers and creatives and people who love to explore and self-reflect. So I'm almost at 4,000 followers that I engage with daily on reflection questions, and it's fabulous experience. And blog posts, and I'm on Instagram, YouTube, some things, and I'm hoping to finally publish my memoir, which contains my soul book. Is like, here's what I've learned about depth psychology, and I share some of my insights in there. But my memoir is all the juicy stories, like all my online dating experiences and what I learned from them, and my being swept up with a younger man, and then in the end, how all of that sort of unleashed as this creativity that I really hadn't expressed before. So yeah, I'm sure there's more in there too. At the top of my website are all the little buttons for everything.
Yeah. And your podcast is called Dose of Depth.
Yes.
You just didn't mention it, but I thought I should, because it's worth a listen.
Thank you.
Well, thank you as always. And I look forward to seeing you again soon.
That sounds good.
Bye.